Welcome to Dig, a podcast about creativity and some other stuff. I'm your host, Yossi Salek, and on today's episode, I'm talking to Tespia Hirways. Tespia is a writer and culture journalist who has written for The Fader, Vice, Nylon, GQ, Good Magazine, and a lot more. In this episode, we talk about how growing up as the other can impact your creative voice, being typecast in your career, and how high school is kind of bullshit. Also, I'm very sorry, but due to what I imagine are karmic reasons, there was an improv class going on next door, so there is an unintentional laugh track that only seems to pop up when we're discussing things like the importance of inclusion or terrorist attacks. And as always, there is a lightning round of things Tespia is digging right now. Here's the interview. Hi, Tespia.
Hi, how are you?
Did I nail it?
Yes, you nailed it. You did too.
I really wanted to, because actually, what I wanted to really start with today, mm-hmm. and this is maybe just personal stuff between me and you, mm-hmm. I was reading a bunch of your pieces to research for this super serious podcast, and
I'm flattered.
I was reading the names they gave me.
Oh, shit. Classic Tespia.
Classic Tespia. And I was like, oh my God, is this my story? And just like insert Yasemin instead of Tespia. And it's like, roll call is the worst part of my day. Too real.
First of all, I didn't know your full name was Yasemin.
Yeah. I mean, I don't not go by it for any reason regarding roll call or anything. My parents just named me that and then from birth called me Yossi. No one ever used that name in reference to myself except for on government documents. Okay. So it was extra confusing to like have to correct the teacher on the first day of like the full name spelling, but then also be like, please call me Yossi.
Okay. I don't usually ask this question, but what's your ethnic identity? Because it sounds very Arab.
It's Iranian, actually.
Okay.
So in the ballpark, next door, technically, I don't know much about.
Not the right linguistic identity, right. But regionally.
My coworker the other day was like, is Iran in Europe? And I was like, no. And he was like, Africa? And I was like, wow, that's the next one you would go to? Like, I was like, this is, you're wildly off. I mean, technically, I guess we could say Asia, but it is called a place. It's the Middle East. Have you not seen one news ever?
Oh, God, that's amazing. I love America.
So that actually leads me to like a question that I was wondering, because that's something that I've started to realize about myself much later in life because I'm 36, how much being the other as a young person, because you were born in America, right? But your parents are immigrants. So mm-hmm. no matter, you know, you're the other, we look the other.
Yeah.
And how much it defined my identity in like really sneaky ways that it didn't reveal themselves until now. Like for me, it was like I fetishized being American as being a bad kid. Mm-hmm. And so it kind of like all the bad stuff I did as a kid and later into my 20s, like all that stuff was like deep down my way of trying to not be other and mm-hmm. to like fit in.
Mm-hmm. But what you don't realize is that all your relatives, like all your Iranian relatives back in Iran are like doing the same shit.
Right?
But it's like for them, it's just like whatever.
Yeah, they're just doing it because that's what people do.
Yeah. It like reminds me of like my entire life. My parents were like, you're never dating. And then I went back to Libya and all my cousins were like, you don't have a boyfriend? I have seven.
you're like, excuse? What?
What?
But I was told.
Yeah, no, I mean, sorry, what was the question?
Was there one? I'm not sure. I do this. I'm just like, let me say a few sentences and then I'll put like a lilt at the end and like maybe they'll think I asked a question. I guess like did that like kind of forced otherness like mm-hmm. manifest in you in ways like as the kind of artist or writer that you are today?
Oh, for sure. I mean, God, even that piece that I wrote, right. like, which I love that piece. But,
I love that piece.
And it kind of launched my careers.
Yeah, and for people listening, it's called The Names They Gave Me. And where was it originally published?
The Toast, which is no longer in existence.
R.I.P. The Toast.
But that piece went like quote unquote viral and like not to brag, but it's in a lot of teaching manuals now.
That's amazing.
It's been reprinted in a lot of educational
guidance. Listen, use your Google. You guys all know the drill. Type in The Names They Gave Me. You'll find it.
It's not on the Toast anymore because the Toast died, but it's been reprinted a lot of places, so you'll find it other places. But even that piece came from a place of like feeling like I have to speak. And I actually was just talking about this with someone recently, which is that I'm Libyan. When I first started college, the Arab uprisings were starting, and I was in journalism school, and I was a Middle Eastern studies major. And so I know it was a lot. It was a lot. And I felt like a lot of like that beginning part of my career was almost predetermined for me because it was like, oh, well, you're the only Libyan person that anyone knows.
And that anyone has ever met ever in this part of the state. So.
Exactly. And A, that, and then like B, like you're the only person of whatever like Arab descent or whatever in this newsroom, and therefore you are the only person who's like qualified to speak on a certain subject, and therefore you should be the person who speaks on that certain subject.
So you felt like you ended up writing a lot of pieces that maybe not that you wouldn't have wanted to, but that like kind of were predetermined and thrust upon you, and you were like, yeah, okay, I'll write this.
Exactly. Like I wrote a lot about a lot of it was like, I mean, in the beginning, it was a lot of, I came from a very traditional journalism background. And so a lot of it was like about Libya and about the uprisings and about everything that's going on. And then that piece that I wrote, the names they gave me, I wrote that when I was in college. It was like, I think the last year I was in college. And I think it was like the first piece that I ever got paid for.
It's incredibly impressive that you were so young.
Thank you. $50.
I mean, as writers know, that's big money.
That is. I hit the jackpot. Usually it's exposure.
Totally. Give me some cred.
But even that piece I wrote from, it's very much like an identity piece, and it's not a piece that like a white person could write unless their name was like Kaylin, spelled K-E-I-G-H-L-I-Y-N, you know, like right. Whatever.
And even if it was, they'd be like, I mean, obviously it's Kaylin. Like how could you ever mispronounce this?
You're wrong. I actually got a lot of comments and like emails from white women who were like, my name is Alexandria, but it's spelled with a Z. And so therefore, and I was like, not the same thing.
The same. Thank you for playing.
Please see yourself out. But I did feel compelled, like for the first few years of my career, to write from a place of like Arabness and a place of Muslimness, and that sucked. It, like, I mean, it didn't suck. Like at the time, I was kind of like, okay, well, this is what I'm meant to do. And a lot of the times, it came from my own sense of like, I need to, like, this is my role or this is how I contribute or whatever. And a lot of the stuff that I wrote at the time, I'm proud of. But at some point, I realized I became a general interest reporter. I went to, right after college, I got hired at Good Magazine. And the editor there, when I got hired, was like, you're not going to be our token Muslim reporter.
Did you cry? Were you like, thank you?
I did. But then like a couple, like a year or two later, the Charlie Hebdo bombings happened in France, and that morning I didn't check Twitter, which is really like a rare occurrence. I didn't check anything. That morning I like got up, made my coffee, was like turning a corner and got in an accident.
Oh my God.
And it was like a really brutal accident. And then I called my editor and I was like, hey, just FYI, I got an accident. I'm going to be late to the editorial meeting. And he was like, yeah, no worries. Just like get in here because we really need you today. Uh-huh. And I was like, interesting. Okay. So I like, you know, I stopped by a Ralph's or whatever and like clean myself off and clean like the car up or whatever. And then I go to the office and I'm still kind of shaken up. Like I hit my head on the steering wheel. And he knows, like, I had told him, I was like, yeah, I'm still really shaken up by this thing, like, by this accident that I was in or whatever, blah, blah, blah. And he was like, yeah. But, you know, we really need you today. And I was like, okay, yeah, what's going on? He was like, he's like, you know, like, this is why we have you here, like, this kind of thing, like, you know, we're in a really good place to have someone like you here in the office. And I was like, what are you talking about? And he was like, you know, the bombings or the shootings. And I was like, what are you talking about? And I like went on Twitter and I was like, ah, fuck. Like I completely missed like everything that had happened. But it just made me feel really gross. Like I was like, okay, first of all, you told me I wasn't going to be your token Muslim reporter when you hired me. But the moment a Muslim does something really terrible, you're like, okay.
We really need you today.
Yeah, we really need you today to be the voice.
And then also disregarding, like, the fact that you actually, like, didn't have that much to give that day. Like I just was in a traumatic car accident. Like, sorry, I can't be the voice of all Muslim people today.
And, you know, I ended up writing something, and it did go viral, too. And it sucks because that thing is like something, the original piece that I wrote, I was really proud of, but then he had like edited it down to like something that I was like mildly proud of. And it just sucks because it was like, okay, I had like, I was pressured in this weird scenario to like write about something that I don't have any terrorism like expertise. Like, I don't know anything about. I don't even know anything about Charlie Hebdo. Like, I don't know anything.
Just Muslim.
Yeah. Also, like, the racial politics of France are completely different than the racial politics of the U.S. Like, it's not in my, like, wheelhouse whatsoever. And he, like, put me in this weird position where he was like, well, you know, here you are. After telling me, of course, that, like, you know, a year or two after telling me, of course, that I was never going to be the token Muslim voice. But I very much felt tokenized.
Did you feel like he wanted like your byline on there to like legitimize the piece?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it's like, oh, look, we have a Muslim writer. And, you know, so this like perspective is authentic.
Yeah.
You know, whatever the fuck. Are we allowed to curse?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. I don't know. Is this nuts. The radio?
It's 1,000,000% not the radio. 1,000,000%, like 12 people are going to listen to this. Like my mom, maybe, but she doesn't have like a bunch of attention span. So she probably already stopped listening. And that's it, Sammy, because she has to edit it. Well, I actually want to come back to exactly this because there's like more questions I want to ask about it. But yeah. I want to first go way more back because I have a couple of questions.
Go for it.
This is a rare occurrence for me to get to like talk to someone, not to tokenize you, that has had a similar like, and it's barely similar because obviously like we are not, but immigrant parents, you know, yes. maybe similar value systems and stuff.
Absolutely.
Like I think about this a lot where did you feel like it was, you kind of had extra hurdles to overcome in becoming a writer, an artist, because you came from a background that maybe like, and not to say they don't value that job, but because, you know, immigrant parents had to like overcome so much to come to this country and make a living, and they didn't do it writing like pop culture articles, you know, like
exactly.
So to them, it's like, that's cute, but like, when are you going to business school? You know?
Well, yeah. I mean, when you think about it, like immigrant families are super risk averse, right? Like, yeah. I mean, they already made, the biggest risk.
Yeah.
Like, they're like, they made the biggest risk. So they're like, we're not gonna, that's it. Like, we're done. They like maxed out on risk.
Totally.
Like they moved to an entirely different country where they don't know the language, where they're completely like alienated and ostracized or whatever. Like, I understand.
All to provide us with a better life.
Yes.
Which we're like, we don't want the better life. We no. want to make art.
So, I like struggle.
Yeah. I want to write like for Complex for like $50 for 100,000 words. Why don't you understand me?
Exactly. I would like to write an essay.
Yeah. Just like
for
please.
Exposure.
Like, was that challenging for you? Like when you told them that's what you wanted to do?
It's challenging right now because I'm broke all the time. And my parents are like, why don't you get a real job? And they're like, you know, my mom is always sending me listings to like teacher positions or whatever. But that's because but back in the day, they assumed I'd be married by now.
Oh, 1,000,000%. They're like, yeah, do that. But like, you know, you'll meet your husband in graduate school.
And your husband will pay the bills.
1,000,000%.
So like my parents were actually really thrilled about me pursuing a writing career. God bless them. Like my parents are actually like pretty progressive for like like a lot of reasons, but at the time they were, the assumption was, oh, how cute, she's going to pursue a writing career, which means she can write from home. Like, obviously you can write from home, like
while you're tend to your children.
While you tend to your children and make your husband dinner. Like, that's such a cute little career. Right. You make some money. And so what they didn't realize, obviously,
is that was not your plan.
Was that, A, I hate men.
Yeah. A, our generation, literally someone will slide into your DMs for 2 years before they even, like, ask you out on a date, let alone we'll get married in 40 years. When in their generation, like, if you smiled at someone, that meant you were engaged.
Or follows you on Instagram.
Yeah.
And then follows you on Instagram for 5 years, likes all your photos, and doesn't ask you out.
Courtship.
But, like, yeah, they assumed that they were, like, kind of initially very supportive of the career. Now they're less so supportive of the career because they're like, oh, well, like, right now my career is, a lot of it is, like, music journalism. And they're like, you're hanging out in a lot of seedy places.
Right. You're like, you're hanging out with rappers.
Unsavory character.
Is this a career that you're doing?
Right now? I know. They're like, what's your job again?
Oh, what's your job again has been a refrain in my life from every member of my family. From jump, like, I'm sorry, what do you do? Like, that is a great question. And the, like, troubling part is, like, I don't know how to answer it thoroughly either. So it's just a big mystery for everybody.
I don't know how to answer it. I'm like, I go to concerts. I talk to some artists once in a while. I, like, write a thing.
But, okay, even before that, this is something that, like, I screamed when I read it.
Yeah.
You went to, like, a very prestigious public high school that, like, you had to, like, take a test to get into. Whoa. That your parents, like, moved you to the city.
You
to, like,
really did research.
Hell yes, girl. Yeah. I am a journalist. But I'm glad I did, because I was like, and then this bitch goes there for 1 year, one smooth year, and then she's like, you know what? I'm 15 years old and I'm dropping out of high school. My parents would have shipped me to Iran. They would have been like, the hell you are. Like, first question is, like, aside from your parents, which is a whole nother pressure thing that I need to separate out, but, like, how did you, at 15 years old, how were you so sure of yourself that you knew that that was the right decision? Like, how did you come to that place where you weren't, like, racked with anxiety and fear that it was going to ruin your whole life? Because that's how I would have felt, sorry. That's how my parents raised me.
Well, I mean, like, my parents, first of all, like, didn't go to school. Like, my dad went to college here, but my mom came here when she was, like, 26. Mm-hmm. So, like, both of them have no experience with, elementary education, right, whatsoever. So they have no idea what the high school system is like. They have no idea.
Oh, you tricked them.
Like, my parents basically know everything they know about high school from, like, watching The Breakfast Club. And so for them, it was like, oh, thank God, you're leaving.
Oh, high school is the scary bad place where there's dating and prom.
Yeah, dating and prom and, right, like, you know, drugs, sure, and sure, all kinds of
keg,
like,
parties.
Exactly. Yeah. So it was like, you know, they were actually really, really relieved to hear that I didn't want to.
Did you, like,
stay in
present
high school
them with a plan, though, where you're like, here's,
oh, yeah,
what's going to happen?
Oh, yeah. I was like, I'm going to take my GED. Okay. Like, I'm going to get my GED. I'm going to go to community college for 2 years and then transfer out. And they seemed pretty, like, down for it. The thing is, like, this is, like, kind of a, it's kind of a thing in, like, a lot of, in, I don't know if this is true of, like, other American Muslim communities, but the American Muslim community that I was part of, like, the Southern California American Muslim community, a lot of girls and even guys did this, which is that they would drop out in sophomore year or sometimes junior year and then do their GED and go to the logic was, the earlier you graduated,
the sooner you can get to college,
the sooner you can get married.
Oh, married. Okay. You couldn't be married while in high school?
No, I just feel like that was, like, unsavory
to the people in high school.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, I know. I mean, it was also, like, the sooner you could become, like, a financially viable person.
I see.
Like, you know, like, right, you can. So my parents were really down for it. Like, my mom, like, came with me to sign out the dropout papers or whatever, and then I went to community college for 2 years. I actually highly recommend it. High school is kind of bullshit.
True. Speak on it.
High school is bullshit. I fucking hated high school, especially the high school that I went to, which is, like you said, a very highly competitive high school. At the time, it was one of the top rated. It was like one of the, I don't know what it is now, but it was like the top high school in the country. You had to take a test to get in. Like, attendance at pep rallies was mandatory because no one would show up to pep rallies.
Because they were like, we need to study.
Exactly. Yeah. Like, attendance to, like, dances and stuff was, like, an extracurricular. It was, like, here's an extra thing.
That sounds fun.
It was – fun is an interesting word to use. I wouldn't personally use the word fun. It was really exhausting.
Yeah, I bet.
And I hated it.
So you didn't have the pressure to achieve academically from your parents per se. It was from the school.
Yeah. Okay. Like, my parents, the environment of my parents, I mean, and I say this like with no judgment whatsoever, because I understand the world that they came from. Like, I understand the place that they came from, and I understand like the social, whatever, like, architecture of the place that they came from. So like, I'm not judgmental about it, but like, I know, like, for a woman, like, you know, they were expecting, like, you get your degree, you get married, right, and if your husband dies, you can get a job.
Right. It just follows the like you said, the social architecture of what they grew up in, the culture they live in.
Yeah, what they know. And yeah. So, like, for them, it was like there was no really, like, real expectation that I would have a career. It was more like you get a degree so that eventually, like, if you should need it,
right,
you could use it. But, like, you don't really need it because
you're going to get married.
You're going to get married and you're going to have a husband.
Yeah.
And he's going to pay for everything, which I still support, honestly. Men should pay for
everything. I'm like, where is my rich husband? I am so tired. I don't want to go to work anymore. Like,
where is my rich husband?
Truly.
Yeah, you know, like, they didn't really need for me to, like, have a career.
Right. Did you feel like that high school impacted your work ethic in any way?
It made it worse for sure. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I have very poor work ethic even now. And to any editors listening to this,
earmuffs.
I'm sorry. Earmuffs. But yeah, I have very poor work ethic. It actually made me worse, I think, at work than it like did. Like, when I got there, I was probably a better worker than when I left.
Right.
And now I'm like, I am incapable of, like, finishing things.
Well, when everything is achievement-based, like, and I don't know if you'll relate to this, like, for me it was like, let me figure out just how to get the thing that needs to be done. Like, how do you get the A? I'll get the A. Like, it had nothing to do with actually doing good work or learning or, like, bettering yourself. It was just like, what are the shortcuts to get the A? Because that's what everybody wants, so I'll just do that thing.
Exactly. And so I hated that. I mean, I loved that school for a lot of reasons, which is that, so prior to going to that school, I was at a school in Redondo Beach, California, which is...
I'm from Torrance.
So I'm so, you know.
Well, you're aware of what you're saying.
I was at Paris Middle School.
Okay. All right. A little different of a vibe.
Half of my classmates were like Instagram models before Instagram models were a thing. They were like blog models.
Yeah, there's nothing more. I know. I was talking to someone recently about, like, and I just like didn't register at the time. I'm sure I did. It like deeply impacted my psyche, and I've been in therapy for 5 years. But like, how mean the kids were about the otherness, and how intolerant they were, and like the fact that it's like you wouldn't even think, like, the names that they called me, and like, and I'm like, oh, I didn't even react strongly enough back then. Like, if that happened now, it would be like an outrage.
It would be over.
It would be over for those hoes. But like, yeah, I mean, they call me like towel head. First of all, I also, by the way, didn't wear a headscarf. Like, my parents aren't Muslim. Like, my mom was raised Muslim. My dad is Jewish, and nobody practiced anything. So, like, towel head was such a stretch. There was such dumb.
I know.
But it was just because I was the only, like, I was Iranian, and that's it.
Yeah. I mean, I wore a headscarf, and I did get called towel head. But I also found that to be such a, like, I was like, really? That's your lazy. Best? It's like.
My favorite was, this was like when I got to have a sick burn, but the Oklahoma City bombings happened when I was in middle school. This ages me, by the way, full dates how old I am. And before they like caught the person, like all the kids were like, hey, Yossi, like, where's your uncle hiding out at? Nah, nah, nah. And I was like, And then they caught, I think it was Timothy McVeigh. And I was like, oh my God, you guys, I'm so sorry about your cousin. It's like so tragic to hear that he's going to jail. I'm sorry. But yeah, I'm sorry. The point was that, like, especially in like the South Bay, which is like predominantly white and I guess Asian.
Very white and yeah. Very Asian. Yeah.
Like, there was no Middle Eastern people. Mm-mm. And it was, they were like, kids were so mean.
They were really mean. They were really, I mean, their parents were also mean. Like, they're like, when I was in, so my parents, we were living in Hawthorne at the time. And mm-hmm. So I was permitted out to Redondo Beach. And my mom would pick me up in the mornings. And sometimes the parents would heckle her.
That's crazy. Those are adult ass people.
And sometimes they would come up to her and be like, you know, you don't have to wear that here.
Like, as if she didn't know that. As if it wasn't like a personal choice. It's like, as if she lived in a cage in her home. Like, the assumptions are so insane.
Yeah, so that's where I came from. Like, the South Bay, like, I mean, the school that I went to for elementary school was very diverse because it was in Hawthorne. Right. But, like, the Paris Middle School, shout out Paris. Love you guys. Paris Panthers. Like, sucked. Like,
yeah, it was all, like, blonde people wearing, like, Quicksilver and Roxy and, like.
Exactly.
With no hips and.
Exactly.
It was a rough time. It was a rough time to come up, you guys.
And then from that, I went to the high school, which was, I was like literally the one non-Asian in the class.
Wow.
Like, so it was like, it was like 99% Asian in that school. And in that community, it was like 97% Asian, like wow. In the entire neighborhood, which was really like, it was, you know, it was nice to be in a predominantly like minority neighborhood. But at the same time, like it was very highly, like not to reinforce a stereotype, but it was really educationally, like academically rigorous and academically competitive for a lot of reasons. So it was like a huge demographic shift for me. Like I didn't know how to deal with that. And, but at the same time, like I didn't have, like I said, like I don't have any work ethic and I couldn't.
Here's the thing about me. I don't have any work ethic.
I don't. This is like the third time I've said this today. Cause I like actually said, I was at the Scientology Center today. I took a tour of the Scientology Center just for funsies.
Oh my God, girl, you in danger. Do not do that. That's like where it starts.
I live in East Hollywood and, a friend of mine, or like an internet friend of mine, Sarah Nicole Prickett, who is also a writer and editor. She was like,
Shout out Adult Magazine, may it rest in peace. I wrote for them once.
Yeah.
She's very smart, very good writer.
We had talked before about going to take a tour of the Scientology Center, and we went to the Scientology Center today, and they were like, what's your one flaw? Like, and I was like, I have no work ethic. And she's like, what do you mean? And I was like, I don't want to work. Shout out to Sarah, who, by the way, was like, I don't think I have any flaws.
That seems on brand for her. I don't know her in real life, but like from internet personality, it seems totally on brand, and I'm here for it. I love that reaction. I'm sorry.
But yeah, I don't have any work ethic, so going to a magnet school is a bad idea. Mm-hmm. Going to any kind of like academically rigorous school is a bad idea. I just felt like stifled as an artist.
But then what did you do? Because then you did do the 2 years of mm-hmm. community college and you went to USC, which is arguably like one of the best journalism programs in the country.
I feel like that's like an easy thing to say for any journalism program because like journalism is not a thing that's hard to learn. I mean, I just think journalism school is bullshit.
I didn't know. I didn't go. I studied communication.
Good.
Which is like not a real thing.
I mean, I was going to say it's also not a real thing, but like journalism is also not a real thing. Like it's just not, it's not real.
Yeah.
It doesn't, there's no reason anyone should go to journalism school. Because let me tell you, the reason you go to college is so that you have a lot of time to read things.
Totally.
And you have a lot of time to learn things.
Yes.
In journalism
school. You learn to be an adult person around other adult people with deadlines.
Exactly. In journalism school, you don't have to read anything.
Seems antithetical.
Yeah, you don't have to read. Like, think about it. Like, what are you going to read?
The New York Times.
Articles.
Yeah.
Which, like, have you seen the clowns writing for the New York Times lately? Like,
speak
come
on. Shout out John Caramanca. Just kidding. We love you, John Caramanca. You're one of the good ones. So wonderful.
But there's, like, a lot of, I mean, Tom Friedman. But, like, there's a lot of, like, shitty, like, you don't have to actually read anything. You don't have to learn anything that you can't already learn, like, just being a reader of the newspaper outside of the...
College is a farce. Unless you're literally going to become a dentist or a doctor or something where you, like, you need to learn, like, the anatomy of the human body or, like, you're an engineer, you need to learn how to draft things. Like, anything in liberal arts, it's
unless
like,
go if you want to. Unless you're a skill. But, like, the thing is, like, as a journalist, like, you could learn to do journalism, like... You know,
not could, like you would arguably better just by doing it.
Just by doing it. Yeah. Like learn it by doing it. Like it's not, you can't, like, first of all, you're wasting your money, like just learning. Like one of my classes was just about like howing, like it was about how to like lay out a newspaper.
Oh, like the printing press?
Yeah. And I was like on graph paper, no less. And I was like, what the
Do you regret going to school?
Oh, 100. I mean, I don't regret going to school. I regret majoring in journalism, which is why I had the Middle Eastern Studies degree added on later.
Right.
But I regret it because it wasn't, there was nothing about deepening my knowledge of anything or deepening my like knowledge base of anything. So they were basically like just churning out these like general interest reporters or whatever, like people who are supposed to be like finance reporters or whatever, like had never taken like an economics class in their entire lives or like whatever. Come on.
Yeah, come on.
Or like environmental reporters that had never taken like a science class, like outside of like the basic like four science classes that you have to take.
Right. That's pretty reflected in media.
Yeah. Which I don't think that you have to take a class, but I think you should be like inquisitive and curious and whatever about whatever you're writing about. And journalism school didn't it's not that they discouraged it, but they didn't necessarily be like, okay, well, if you want to be a music reporter, here's what you have to do. Or if you want to be a film reporter, here's what you have to do.
Right.
It was just like
very general.
Very general, like go forth and write or go forth and report.
Did it help you get a job?
It did help me get a job, but that's because like USC, like many private schools, has like a cult-like devotion
to their alumni. I know I went there for graduate school.
Yeah.
My dad's greatest sadness is that I don't use the alumni network at all. I didn't go to any of the mixers. I didn't go to any pep rallies. I didn't go to any tailgates. I was like, I'm sorry, I'm not a joiner. I don't know what you want from me. I'm not doing this.
I did get my job at Good Magazine started out as an internship, and I got that internship through one of their job fairs. Okay. And so, yeah, it was like very beneficial. Their resources are incredible, but it's like, I wish I got more out of my Middle Eastern Studies degree than I did out of my journalism degree, for sure. Like, my journalism degree, I can't remember anything I learned in any of the classes, mostly because they were taught by these old white men journalists from, like, the LA Times in 1965.
I know. I feel like college, like, if you're going to go... 17-year-olds listening, like, just go study something you're deeply interested in with no like point of using it as a job. Like, if you love Chaucer, just go study Chaucer for 4 years. It'll be awesome. And then you'll get a job in something.
Learn either, if you're not acquiring a very specific skill, like being a doctor or whatever, like being a lawyer, being whatever, if you're not acquiring a very specific skill, you should be acquiring a deep knowledge base of something.
Yeah. Be an English major. That's fun. Like, study art. If just because you're interested in it, study history because you like it.
Exactly. Exactly. I can't.
We didn't do that. So we're hypocritical. That.
That's why I'm broke.
Yeah. Amen. Okay, let's jump back forward.
All right, let's do it.
So we talked about a little bit before. You have written a lot of pieces about your background. Muslim, being brown in general.
I have.
In the junior high magazine interview. Shout out junior high magazine.
What's up,
Faye? And junior high, Faye Orloff. I wrote for that as well. You talked, and you kind of touched on it earlier, like the push and pull between like this pressure that you feel to be political in your writing because it's like something that you owe to the world, for lack of a better word, or some, a way that you can make the world a better place. And like the world is a fucking shitstorm, and of all times now is the time where it's like, I need to contribute in a way that's productive.
Yeah.
I being you, because I don't do that. I do a podcast about fun stuff. But on the other, you know, and feeling this pull to just like, just want to be the voice, as you said, be the voice of just me.
Yeah.
How do you like negotiate those two things?
It's hard. I mean, at this point, I just think that everything you do, no matter what, is political. Like, even now, as a mostly music journalist, like who I profile or who I write about or whose music I like, I think that's very political.
Or even the fact that you're the one writing it and you're the one taking up that space.
Exactly.
Is political in and of itself, that it's not another white guy.
Exactly, yeah. But I definitely don't feel compelled anymore. I mean, there was a time where I felt compelled to like write about every like, you know, not write about every terrorist attack, but to like respond to like everything and be like, oh, well, you know, Muslims don't believe in this, Muslims don't believe in this, whatever, blah, blah, blah. And that was really tiresome and tiring and exhausting, and I don't like it.
No, I don't want to do it anymore. And that is fair. It is a lot. It's a lot of emotional labor. And writing is emotional labor always.
Yes.
But that's like triple emotional labor.
Yeah, it's a lot of emotional labor. And it's like also it puts you in a very vulnerable position because you put your stuff out there and, you know, like I've written for Complex or I've written for whatever, and you have these insane like audiences, like Vice's audience or like Red Bull's audience or whatever, and you have these crazy audiences that don't know who you are. They're just reading something out of context, or they're reading something about you out of context, and they like make these like wild assumptions or whatever, and it sucks. You're not protected in the way that, like, for example, editors are protected because their names aren't on the pieces or whatever.
Even though they touch it a lot and they shape it a lot of times and they steer it.
Oh,
they assigned it.
Steer. Exactly. They, like, did, like, they have their hands in it, but they're not, their names aren't on it. My name is on it. And so you get associated with a certain thing or you, whatever it is, it's really hard. It's not fun. And the thing is, I don't believe in being apolitical. Like, I don't think that's a, you know, there's that whole thing about like silence is complacence or whatever. Mm-hmm. I believe that. Like, I do think that. And I don't think that any of my work is apolitical even now. Like, I think a lot of the stuff that I do or whatever, like even, you know, the music artists that I choose to feature or the music artists that like what I talk to them about, you know, even if it doesn't end up in the final edits or whatever, like I'm very particular about what I talk to them about or what I, you know, I recently talked to, I talked to an artist named Charlotte Day Wilson and who's an R&B artist. And you know, I asked, she's a white woman, she's a, like, and I asked her about, like, being a white woman in R&B, and, you know, it didn't make it into the final copy, but it was important to me to, like, try, because I think that's, you know, any white person operating, or even non-black person operating within a black space, or operating within a black genre, like, needs to be aware of like the context or whatever, you know, that they're operating in.
Totally.
It didn't make it into the final copy, but it was really important for me to
be. You made the effort to get it in.
Yeah. And, you know, for example, like one of the biggest pieces of my career that I wrote, it was about this community on Tumblr called Lift Blur, and it was like these young women who were shoplifting.
Oh.
And like they shoplifted as a form of activism.
Oh, like they would shoplift from places that they disagreed with, or it was just like the act of shoplifting was like anarchist?
Yeah, it was like anti-capitalist. And then also like they had like they were like very like pro-Bernie, and then they were also like feminists, and they also they had like a 10 commandments of shoplifting, which is like thou shalt not shoplift from like mom and pops, or thou shalt not like whatever, like snitch on another shoplifter or whatever. Like thou shall only rip off corporations or something like that.
It's very interesting.
And within that piece, I had like one paragraph about race, and it was about the fact that a lot of these women on Tumblr who were like bragging about their shoplifting were white women, because obviously black women and
don't have that luxury.
Don't have that luxury. Yeah. And black men definitely don't have that luxury. Like,
totally.
You walk in, like, if you're a black man and you walk into a store, like, eyes are going
to
be on you.
Yeah, you're already presumed to be shoplifting.
Yeah. And me and my editor, I love her to death, and she's a mentor now. But me and my editor, like, went to, like, we had an argument, not an argument, but like we definitely had a negotiation about it. Like I was like, I want to keep this paragraph in. She wanted to take it out because she felt like it was such a like
hot button.
Yeah. She was like, why are you putting this like really like fiery conversation in the middle of this?
But because it's part of like, it's part of the context. Like it's,
yeah,
it's not, it's kind of fake to exclude.
Yeah, outside of that, the girls themselves that I had interviewed talked about the fact that they were white and could get away with it because they were white.
Right.
And for me, like, race is never, like, as fiery as white people perceive it.
Right.
It's like, just
they're
like
the ones that feel attacked.
Yeah. Like, white people are like, race, oh no. Whereas, like, me, I'm just like, yeah, and by the way, they were white, and here's, like, the situation. And that's why it was one paragraph. And she was like, well, if you're going to make this about race, you should make the whole thing about race. And I was like, no, it just needs to be a paragraph. Like,
I didn't make it about race. I just included the
the one paragraph. And she was, I mean, like I said, she's a great editor. I love her. But, like, you know, we had an argument about it, and eventually it stayed in. And, like, for me, that's political even. Like, it's, like, not even, like, a it's not a political article. It was just about some girls who shoplift on Tumblr, you know? Right. But it was really important for me to have that in there and to have other details in there about them, like, for example, supporting Bernie or supporting, you know?
Right. You said something really interesting, and also I think it was the junior high piece, about the luxury of not even having to think about that.
It's crazy to me. Okay, so like I've been kind of binging this really awful show on Netflix called The Girlfriend's Guide to Divorce.
Okay.
It's really bad. But like immediately my first like watching it, I was like, oh my God, this is about four white women. It turns out one of the women is like Puerto Rican, but I feel like they added in that fact later.
Right. They were like, no, this one's Puerto Rican. You're like, okay.
But there's like a lot of stuff where I was like, I would never make a show like this.
Totally. I see it a lot in TV. I notice it so much in TV where I'm like, really? Especially in TV shows that it's not part of the narrative or the story that everyone needs to be white. Like, not that that's, and that is sometimes the case, but like in a show where like, mm-hmm. anyone could be any race and you still make everyone white, it's just like mind-blowing.
Yeah, it's like where do you live?
Yeah,
what do you like, how is this possible? Like no one saw this and was like, oh
yeah, oof, this is, well, I don't, we can, I feel we've covered that part. But I want to talk to you more about your work. It seems like you write about culture and pop culture, but it seems like you write more about music.
Mm-hmm.
And is that just out of a love for music, or is it out of love for personalities that exist in music? Mm-hmm. Like what kind of draws you to writing about music? Because you're not a critic.
I'm not a critic at all.
Yeah.
No,
you're more of a culture writer.
Yeah. I'm definitely more of a, like a reporter. Like I like doing profiles, that kind of thing. It's funny because it actually started out when I was working at Good. I was a general interest reporter, but at the same time, like I said, like I found myself pigeonholed in a lot of ways into doing like Arab, Muslim, brown stuff or whatever. And I ended up, you know, there was, I think like one of the first ones was doing a profile of this artist named El Sarah. who's like a Nubian artist and comes from like a quote unquote Muslim culture or whatever. And I wrote about her, and then I wrote about Mashrou Leila, which was a queer Lebanese band from Lebanon. It's funny because at the time, that same editor who had told me, like, he was like, yeah, you're not going to be a token Muslim editor or whatever, or writer or whatever. Like, after I had done, like, a couple of those profiles of, like, these brown musicians, he was like, yeah. He's like, you just don't want people to think you're, like, a one-trick pony.
Wow.
Like, you know, you're just doing a lot of, like, brown stuff. And I was like, okay, well, you didn't tell, like...
Yeah, you didn't tell Jonathan after you wrote about the National Bon Iver and the War on Drugs and, like, 50 other white dude bands, Mac DeMarco, like, that he was a one-trick pony.
I know.
Did you?
I know.
Trevor got to write whatever he wanted.
I know. Trevor, like, profiled Father John Misty, like, 7 times. So what about him? Like, why isn't he a one-trick pony?
Honestly, fuck Trevor.
but when I was doing those, and I was doing them in my capacity as like a brown, quote unquote, brown Muslim Arab writer, I like realized I really liked writing about music and writing about musicians because I really love music and I really love culture in general. So I ended up just doing a lot more music stuff. And in my final year at Good, or within my final year at Good, like maybe like my last month or so, I got offered a position with Red Bull Music Academy to do like a month of promotion for their month long festival. They had right. do like a month long festival. I was like, yeah, fuck yeah, I'll do that. And so I quit my job. And again, I really love Good. Like, they gave me 3 years of my life, really, like, built up my skills as a writer, as an editor, all of that. And then went to Red Bull Music Academy, and that kind of solidified it for me. It was like, oh, yeah, this is what I really want to do, is, like, I want to do stuff about music. I really love music. I love dancing. It's like... Okay. If you follow me on my Finsta, you know I love dancing.
Wait, what's a Finsta? I'm sorry, I'm old.
A Finsta is like an Instagram, but it's like your fake Instagram. It's like your real Instagram, actually.
Like it's like your private one that only your friends follow.
Like only your like close people follow.
We are like maybe a generation apart, and so I'm very sorry that I'm like not down with the hip lingo. Oh, and I apologize to the listeners. That
I did a whole drunk TED talk about... Finstas. Yeah, that was like I did a whole entire like PowerPoint presentation. I'll send it to you. Don't worry.
I need to see it. Okay, so on your Finsta, it shows how much you love dancing.
I love dancing. I love music. I love a lot of nightlife culture, like
raves.
I actually love raves. There are raves.
I haven't been outside past 9 p.m. in like many years. I don't know what's going on out there.
Well, a lot of my friends do like throw like warehouse parties that are.
Good Lord.
Can conceivably be qualified as raves, but they're not really raves. They're like, and it's a lot of people of color, like a lot of like, and you know, I don't co-sign a lot of what Drake says, but I will say that Drake said something about like club culture in LA, which is that it's very segregated.
Right.
And in LA, like a lot of the best music culture and the most integrated, quote unquote, again, like integrated club, like music culture is in the warehouses and it's in those like underground, like semi illegal,
totally.
Like spaces that, you know, like that's where you are going to get like the most diversified group of people.
Yeah. Artists, musicians, the DJs.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Like just being around a bunch of people of color and like twerking until the sun comes up. It doesn't happen in a lot of the nightlife spots in LA, but it does happen in those like underground parties. And a lot of people color like it's great because, I mean, it's not great. It's like, it sucks because those people of color had to seek out alternative spaces because they were not welcomed, or were not like allowed to,
right, or empowered to, or hired to.
Yeah, be they in weren't the allowed to DJ like spaces. Hollywood spots or whatever. Right. Or like, you know, a lot of like, you know, I've dated some club promoters or whatever.
Who amongst us?
Who amongst us
has not?
I've dated some DJs, and they all say like, you know, it's like rap, hip hop music is not seen as like, it's not seen as like, you know, quote unquote, like classy as like other music that they want played in the clubs. So underground, you know, the underground scene emerged in LA specifically emerged as a response to that. And that's great.
Being a writer, no, I feel it, you know, I phrase it this way all the time, and I think people that are writers tend to understand, like, writing is not an art form that is particularly soothing or pleasant. It's not sculpting. It's not painting. Not to say those are easy. That's not – but it's grueling, and it is devastating, and it makes you want to walk into traffic. I'm just wondering, like, what are your tools, like, to keep going when – like you're blocked, or we're like, you're like, I'm on deadline and I really just like can't sit down and write this. Like, how do you keep yourself focused or balanced, or like your mental health up to speed? Cause I think it's particularly challenging, especially if you're a freelance writer and you're writing from home and you don't have the structure. Like, what are your individual like things that you rely on or that you have to do to just like not jump off a bridge?
Damn. I mean, just like the need to make rent.
No, that's, I mean, that is a fair and excellent driving force.
I'm just like, I need to make rent and I need to like pay for groceries next month. And so you just have to write. You just have to write right now.
Do you have any like art practice outside of your writing that's just for yourself? Art or writing practices?
Yeah, I mean, I write a lot of creative writing. I do a lot of creative writing on the side. And the other thing that I've been doing a lot more is just like kind of event throwing. Cause like event throwing helps me build a like community in a way that, is really difficult in LA.
Right.
Like,
and it's social in a way that, I mean, writing is deeply lonely.
It's so
very isolated. It just by nature, it's isolated. You do it alone.
Exactly. Yeah, it's really sad. It's like you're in your apartment all alone. Like my roommate's an artist and she goes to the studio to do her art or whatever.
Around. Yeah.
And so I end up in the apartment alone all day. I think part of it, like outside of the financial, like, you know, whatever, I do a lot of event throwing just because it helps me meet people and it helps me like build connections. And anyone you talk to who knows me, like they will tell you like my other talent, like outside of writing, is just connecting people and like, oh shoot, you should know this person, or this person like does this and you should know this person. And building that community, I think that's like my best art practice, I think, if art practice is the word for it.
No, I think it totally is. And it's fulfilling in a way, probably, that.
It is, you know, like, it is like, okay, so like recently I fell on a pole and I got this like nose injury and I fainted and had to get like into the ambulance.
I'm sorry.
And went to the hospital and I woke up in the hospital and there were like, 7 people there, like friends, and they were all people who like didn't know each other.
Oh my god!
Before, like, you know, it was just like
you were their nucleus.
Yeah, and it was such a good feeling. It was like a feeling of like all these people came first of all in the middle of the night to like come see me at the hospital. Second of all, like they're all people who've like benefited from knowing each other. Like outside of like after like introducing them, like they all benefited from knowing each other. And third of all, it just like made me feel like I had this like very close circle, like very close, like community of people, of friends that I could rely on in times of like really in times of distress.
Yeah.
And I think that's like the most important kind of like, if art doesn't create community or if art doesn't like, then it doesn't, it's kind of not meaningless, but it's not as useful as it can be.
Totally. I'm going to give you a couple of like topics of things and you just like co-sign something that you're into right now.
Okay.
Okay, like what's a book that you're really into that you would recommend right now?
Freshwater by, I'm going to fuck up her name.
Should we spell it out phonetically?
Can I look it up real quickly?
Yeah.
Okay, I'm going to look it up real quickly.
Sammy said we have all the time in the world. She definitely didn't say you have to go right now.
Hold on, I'm going to, okay. Akweke Emise? Freshwater by Akweke Emise. I don't remember. I'm probably fucking up her name. But okay. Freshwater, one word.
Got it. Freshwater. That's the book.
Yeah.
Secondly, an album.
I just did a profile of Rico Nasty for The Fader.
Which is awesome. You guys should read it.
And she just released an album called Nasty. And it is very, very, very good. I will also co-sign Paramore's last album.
So good. After Laughter. It's amazing.
After Laughter is so,
so good.
Fucking it's buoyant. Good. And it didn't get any attention.
Not as much as it should have.
Paramore's last album didn't get, like, After Laughter didn't get as much attention as it should have. So After Laughter and Nasty by Rico Nasty, top albums of the past 5 years.
Okay. Film.
Film. I don't watch as much movies.
You could say TV as well.
Oh, I could say TV. I really like On My Block on Netflix.
Okay.
It's a really good. I've also just started. I haven't finished it because I have a really short attention span, but I just started watching this movie on Netflix called Ali's Wedding. And it's about an Australian Muslim guy in Australia, obviously. And I think so far it's like a really pretty interesting depiction. But like I haven't finished it yet, so, you know.
Okay. Well, we'll halfway trust you on your opinion.
Yeah.
Media or publication? Like website? Newspaper.
I really love The Outline. I think The Outline doesn't get enough attention. I really love The Outline. Also, The Fader.
Fader's great.
I fucking love The Fader. I love all the editors there. I think the people there are really hardworking, and I love their dedication to putting on new talent.
Last,
etc.
Anything.
Trader Joe's cauliflower gnocchi.
I've just recently heard about that from my friend Bethany. Shout out Bethany. And she texted me to tell me how good it was and that I need to immediately go get it. And now you're the second person to go sign it. So
I'm going to hit the TJ's. It's so good. Trader Joe's cauliflower gnocchi. And also, okay, wait. So Trader Joe's also has a garlic paste that's really good. That's like, it's kind of like Zanku chickens.
Mm, so good. Yeah, like, I get that. And I can eat an entire container in one sitting with Ruffles chips.
Yes.
Because I'm disgusting.
It's delicious. But if you go to John's, which is like the Armenian Vons.
Girl, I've been knowing about John's. I grew up going to John's. It's the Armenian Russian Vons. It has literally the same logo. They just changed the first letter to J. The
original
It's on
scammers.
Fountain, I believe. Fountain and like
they've got multiple
La Brea,
locations.
Yeah.
They've got
multiple
locations. I do go to the one on Santa Monica, but they've also got a garlic paste that lasts a little bit longer than the Trader Joe's version.
That's a great cosign.
So that's my cosign. It's all food cosigns. All
right. Thanks, Taspia.
Anytime.
Dig was recorded at the Ruby Studios in Los Angeles by the Wind Beneath My Wings, Sammy Jr. Our incredibly catchy theme song is by Heather Fortune. You can find more of Heather's music, none of which sounds like this, but is very goth and very good, at heatherfortune.bandcamp.com. heatherfortune.bandcamp.com. You can follow us at Dig the Pod on Twitter and Instagram. Thanks for listening.